All around this planet, they continue to receive incredible UFO reports constantly. Up next, L.A. Marzulli, the latest research exploring the various UFO phenomena happening globally, such as alien abductions, breeding programs, and contact with entities that many contactees say may be messengers of deception. L.A. Marzulli is best-selling author of the Nephilim Trilogy. His new nonfiction book, of course, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, The Coming Great Deception, and the Luciferian Endgame, connect the dots that other authors have overlooked. He possesses, by the way, an in-depth knowledge of UFOs and other supernatural phenomena. This has got all the makings, L.A., of a classic coast-to-coast show. How are you? Welcome back.
I'm great. Happy New Year to you, sir.
You too. Looking forward to this. So how's life been?
It's, well, the economy is in the tank, as we all know, and
yeah.
We are feeling the pinch here. California is on the state of bankruptcy, and, you know, things are, everyone's proceeding very cautiously, including myself.
Yeah, that's probably the smart way to do it. I don't think people should shut down their lives by any means, but we just need to kind of tippy-toe a little carefully these days.
Strange times.
Yeah, absolutely. What's been going on in your UFO research?
Well, I do a lot of radio shows, and this is my favorite show. And you guys have always been so open and just allowing me a platform basically to say whatever I want, no holds barred, and I really appreciate that. There are other shows in which I have literally been censored, and I won't mention any names. One show in particular really got me got my dander up in the sense that no matter what I presented, it was scoffed at. It was ridiculed. In other words, the evidence never was enough. And I got kind of angry. And from that anger, and really from Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, the offspring of that book became the Alien Interviews. And what I did is I went out and collected 17 people who have been either had direct contact. And one of my criteria, George, was specifically people who have had direct contact, not from books, not from, you know, well, I heard this from a these are people
right.
that actually had contact or seen the phenomena, close encounters of the fourth kind. Some of the people who came on the record were Dr. Jacobs, Dr. Roger Lear, Dr. Jesse Marcel, retired Major George Fowler, Dr. Lynn Kataya, the Phoenix Lights, and others. And then, of course, there's contactees and people who witnessed cattle mutilations, people who have had literally telepathic communications with these beings, abductees, people who stopped the abductions, and that's all in the Alien Interviews. And the whole purpose of the book was to say that and really, the book has two parts. The first is to establish that there is something going on, that the phenomena is real and burgeoning. It's not going away. And the second is to tie it into supernatural occurrences that have happened throughout history as a possible answer to what the phenomena is. So that's at the very end of the book. And by the way, George, you know, I really, during the interviews, I mean, everybody has a platform. There's no commentary. I don't weigh in on and critique each person's interview, nothing like that. There's a slight intro, a slight outro, and what's really neat about the book, because it's so interactive, it's an e-book. It's like $5.99. You can get it from my site, lamarzulli.net. But what's great about it is you can link to their sites immediately. So one click and you're at their site, or you're at YouTube looking at the video, or you're, you know, listening to a radio program from somewhere or a file. It's just really interactive and great. So the whole purpose of it is to allow the skeptic to take a look at the information here and weigh in. And then, of course, there's people that have that have no clue as to what's happening and are kind of interested, mm-hmm. but not sure where to begin. And that's really what the book's about.
Good for you. Okay, let's go through, because you've done a great job categorizing some of the players involved in ufology and some of the events. And let's go through each one. And it's, you know, we've got a three-hour program here, Lynn, with the phone calls. We'll take some time talking about them, what you've come up with, and your impressions and your views. And by the way, you're very well respected, and it is our privilege to have you on this program.
I appreciate that.
The abduction phenomena, Dr. David Jacobs. Give me your thoughts on him.
Well, one of the most amazing statements in the interview from Dr. Jacobs is when I asked him, I said, when did you start to realize that this might be real? And it was a period of time after he was interviewing people who had allegedly been abducted. And, of course, you know, it may be one or two of these people, and you kind of go, oh, well, you know, people are that's kind of coincidental. But after, like, six or a dozen or two dozen or whatever, at some point there was a tipping point. And he, this is the quote. I'm going to read it directly. This is from Dr. Jacobs, and he says, I went into sort of a shock tailspin. I said to myself, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, repeatedly for about 6 months. Then I began to get over the shock, and eventually it became routine for me, if that's imaginable. In other words, there was a tipping point where he understood or began or realized, the light bulb went off, that this isn't like sleep paralysis or this is the real deal. This is really happening. And, of course, the further he got into it, it's just a fascinating interview. And he's real candid. You know, all through it. And I know you've interviewed him before, obviously. Mm-hmm. Been on the show probably many times. But he, in my opinion, he looks at the what's going on specifically with the abduction phenomena and the breeding program that he believes, of course, is happening. And he believes now that the breeding program has reached a point, probably a tipping point, where the hybrids can pass as humans. You can't tell anymore. And this, of course, is very unnerving. And he looks at it. He's not sure, you know, whether it's benevolent or malevolent. I think he kind of weighs in. He doesn't have a good feeling about it. Let's put it that way.
No, he feels there could be something sinister here.
Yeah.
And he's one of the few, Lynn, that feels that way. But the fact that he's so well-respected and so credentialed at what he does, it kind of makes you wonder.
Well, it does. Of course, I weigh in with him on that. I mean, I side with him on that, I should say, completely. I think that what we're looking at, and of course I'm tipping my hand here probably a little too early, but I think that it's part of a coming great deception. And I think what we're looking at, and you know, it's funny, when I walk through the whole idea of abductions with people, I say, let's just look at it. Let's just, you know, strip it away and look at it. You're abducted in every country on the planet. That's an offense. You can be put in prison for abducting someone against their will. Then they perform sexual experiments on you against your will. And, you know, what if you're like a minor? What if you're like 14 or 12, which one of the people I interviewed, Karina Sable, she's been abducted since she was a little girl. So now we literally have sexual molestation, which, again, is punishable.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? So and this is across the board in every culture. These acts are heinous acts. These acts are punishable by jail time or even worse in some societies. So it's, you know, the idea that the abduction phenomena continues and that these people are being taken against their will, right? You know, when you strip it down and you just look at what's going on, surely if they were really benevolent, good, you know, extraterrestrials, they would know what they were doing. I mean, if they can come from millions of miles and land on this planet, they got to know that what they're creating is a climate of fear. And that's what every person that I've talked to who's an alleged abductee always says the same thing, that they are literally terrified. And they, of course, they can't move. They're paralyzed, and they are terrified when this thing is going on. And you would think that, well, at least knock them out so they don't have to experience, you know, the terror. And yet
right,
I believe
right.
that these entities feed off of it like a psychic vampire. Hence, I think they're malevolent.
I would agree with you, Lynn. And what's also fascinating is all these millions and millions of people who've claimed to have been abducted,
mm-hmm.
they can't be all having problems. They can't be all having mental issues. They can't be all making this up.
Well, this is what the skeptics will always do. And Dr. Jacobs, one of the questions I asked him point blank was, you know, how do you deal with skeptics that come on and say this is nothing more than sleep paralysis? And Dr. Jacobs answered, and I'm just paraphrasing here. Basically, he said that most of the skeptics ignore the data. They won't look at the data. And many of these questions have been posed already decades ago and have proven to be basically rabbit trails. And so I would agree that all these different people that are experiencing the same thing, like when you read Karina Sables, who is a who's an abductee, when you read her story, it's a classic abduction. And her last one, of course, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but her last abduction, I think, was in 2005. At least that's what she reported to me in the interview. And she talks that she was abducted in front of nine people. Nine different people saw this thing, witnessed it, saw the craft, saw her taken aboard the craft. There were trace evidences on her body. She began to lose her hair. There was a scoop mark, you know, radiation poisoning, sickness, that type of stuff. She was manifesting, and nine people witnessed it. And that's just one.
That's an incredible case.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And she's got medical records with that.
And she's convincing, isn't she?
I think she is. Look, I wasn't there. I don't know. But and this is the whole point of the book, The Alien Interviews. You start getting 17 people together, and you listen to the stories, and they come from different worldviews, different paradigms. So everyone has a voice. You know, and I don't weigh in on any of that. I mean, I don't judge that or don't say a word about it. I tell you what I think at the end of the book, but everybody has their say in the book, uncensored. And it's really interesting, you know, different people have different viewpoints. And one of my phrases, which I love to say, is that, you know, surely we may differ in our explanation of to what the phenomena is, but we agree that the phenomena is happening and it's burgeoning and it's not going away. And I think that's really important to get to, especially the skeptics and the people still that look at this and kind of scoff at it and laugh and poke fun and ridicule and, you know, dress people up like aliens and then hold a press conference like Fife Symington did in you know, during the Phoenix Lights.
Of course, now he's apologized for that.
Exactly, which is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you also believe, though, that some of these abductees could have been abducted by military types or black ops type folks?
Well, if they are, I believe there's collusion there. And this goes back to the whole, you know, World War II Operation Paperclip, where I believe that something, you know, we've talked about this before. There was a portal probably opened over Germany, which allowed these entities to come through in mass. The sacrifice for that, I believe, was the Holocaust, 6 million, which is a blood sacrifice. In my opinion, it was a deliberate occult maneuver. It cracked something open, and allowed these entities to come through. We know that from the Foo Fighters, 1945. Everyone saw these things, didn't know what they were. Even Steven Spielberg in his documentary slash movie Taken, which is 20 hours of television, he starts off with the Foo Fighters. The whole idea that I believe that this kind of came over, perhaps with Operation Paperclip. I know Mike Heiser believes that also. So something was open. You've got all these ex-Nazis running around here, and some of these guys were occult adepts. So the contact could have, let's say, been established in Germany and then literally brought over here. So that's why some of the abductees report seeing military types and U.S. personnel along with the Greys or whatever. So it's kind of a bizarre, you know, bizarre mix there, but too many people have said the same thing, which leads me to believe that there's a lot of credibility there.
Tell me about Joe Jordan. You know, he's a co-founder of what was a research group called CE4. Mm-hmm. He was, I don't know if he still is a part of MUFON in Florida, is he?
I'm not sure of that. I think he still is, yes.
But he's controversial.
He's very controversial. He was one of the keynote speakers at the Roswell convention this year. And for the listeners who don't know what that is, it's, you know, 1947 Roswell crash. And every year now they have a sort of a convention. They have different speakers. I know Stanton Friedman came in one year, which must have just been fantastic. And anyway, other people. And they had Joe Jordan discuss the abduction phenomenon. Remember, this is a guy that looked into this, was a MUFON director, and started looking at the abduction phenomena, wasn't really sure what this was. In other words, he went from sightings, which were okay, because there was maybe some trace evidence and the witness and some photographs and blurry photographs and that type of thing. And after like maybe a couple of dozen of those, he moved into the abduction phenomena because it was close encounters with the fourth kind, direct contact. I mean, these people had something going on. And what he was discovering, he came upon a case where this one particular person who was abducted stopped the abduction phenomena cold by evoking a name of Jesus. Now, before your listeners start turning it off, I'm not talking religion here, so let's just throw that right away. And this guy was a Christian, apparently, and he evoked the name of Jesus. He cried out to Jesus during the abduction. Now, Dr. Jacobs doesn't believe that any of this will work. So we have a disparity between what Jordan has found and Dr. Jacobs has found. And I leave that to the reader and to your audience to, you know, weigh in themselves, weigh the evidence, look at it, and make their own conclusions. What's interesting is Jordan went off the record, so to speak, and called up several researchers in the abduction phenomenon. This is right in the alien interviews, right out of the book, when I asked him, you know, what did you find, what happened? And he said that off the record, people were willing to talk about that, yes, they too had come across cases where abductees allegedly were able to stop the experience by evoking the name of Jesus. And they didn't know what to make of this thing. But Jordan believed that there was almost like a cover-up or a conspiracy in the UFO. And this is heavy stuff. Almost a cover-up or a conspiracy in the UFO community not to let this information out. There's almost I don't know, maybe because people look at it and dress it up in religious clothes. I don't know, but there's definitely a stigma against that, and he ran up to it, against that. So cut to 2008 in July at the Roswell conference. Mm-hmm. Jordan is talking about this, and he has a PowerPoint presentation. I've seen the DVD. It's fascinating. And, you know, he builds it precept by precept by precept, line by line, lays his case down.
Very organized, isn't he?
Very organized. Very methodical. It's almost like a court of law. In fact, that's how he kind of presents it. It's like you're in a court of law. Here's the evidence. Look at it, look at it, look at it. Well, at the end of the presentation, he has a dozen people who have claimed to be abducted who have stopped their abduction experience by evoking the name of Jesus. And he blew the roof off the room. I mean, people were just blown away by that. Here, it's not, you know, it goes from the realm of, well, I heard about this, to here are 12 living human beings. You can go talk to them. They're not crazy, and this is what happened, and this is how they stopped it. Which, you know, goes to the where I'm coming from. I think we're looking at interdimensional beings, and you know, I don't want to give that away right now in the first hour. We'll talk about that
later. We've got to build this thing, Glenn. I love it. Well, okay, and that's a great segment on abductions. But you also looked in and interviewed folks from Stephenville, Texas, a story that Linda Moulton-Howe's been covering for us since this has happened, a story that we did on our sci-fi pilot, one of them, and you looked at this very bizarre case.
Well, it certainly is. I interviewed Ricky Sorrell, and I've interviewed him numerous times. And the reason why I did this, I would talk to him and get the story from him and then call him back a couple of weeks later, and the story would be exactly the same. No changing, no embellishment of the story. I'd wait a couple more weeks, call him back, Ricky, what's going on? Same thing. And maybe he would add, well, you know, we just were buzzed a week ago by three black helicopters over the house, unmarked, and they were there for like an hour, stuff like that. And so his phone was tapped. I mean, I literally called him, and the phone was just click, 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 click. I mean, the phone was tapped. He did see black helicopters, but that is after he came on the record with the local media, according to his story, I mean, this thing is just bizarre. He's out deer hunting, and we've talked about this before, mm-hmm. but some of the listeners probably don't know. And what's great about this, you know, George, is we're going quickly. The little vignettes, little thumbnail sketches, but we're building a case here that the phenomenon is real. It's not going away, and it's happening, and that's the whole point of the book. But
right.
Sorrells is out there deer hunting around January 1st, and he gets caught up in some brambles. He looks up as he's struggling to get out, and above him, directly above him, is this huge craft. I mean, huge craft. And Stanton Friedman, I know, and you were on that show, Larry King.
Yeah.
And, you know, Stanton Friedman said, well, this is a mothership. I mean, this, and it is. This thing was probably, well, Sorrell said he couldn't see the end of the thing, and he looked in all directions. He could never see the end of it. So it's sort of like Independence Day. I mean, you're underneath this huge craft. He told me on the record that at one point he thought about firing his gun at it and then thought better off it.
Smart move, right?
Real smart move.
Hey, Lynn, stay with us. We're going to be right back with you as we continue into your investigation, these various areas of UFO phenomena. Lynn's website, by the way, spiraloflife.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Find out why zillions are signing up for the free Coast Zone newsletter. You get it every morning. It's an e-newsletter, shows up at your computer. It's called the Coast Zone, part of Coast to Coast AM. To register for the free newsletter, always free, just go to coasttocoastam.com. There on the homepage, you'll see the little section there for registering. And you'll start getting it probably tomorrow morning, that quickly. It's a free Coast Zone newsletter. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Lynn Marzulli, author of The Alien Interviews, Conversations with People Who Experience UFO Contacts. Back to Stephenville, Texas, we go. You also had an opportunity to chat with Angela Joyner, did you not?
I did. Before I get that, George, let me just finish up one important point I want to make, that Ricky Sorrell, when he was underneath the craft, he experienced something, and he saw something, which ties back into a little later when we start talking about the Phoenix Lights. He saw like a wave. He described it as a mirage that kind of like was between him and the craft. In other words, especially when it moved away, he could see this like shimmering. And just remember that, because when we get to the Phoenix Light, I think there's a correlation there. But yes, I interviewed a reporter. And she works for one of the local papers in the area. And it was interesting. She agreed to come on the record. There were several other people that I emailed and called, and just nothing, never got a response. But she came right on and very candid about what was going on. And one of the points that she made, and I want to stress this too, that there's such a fear among the populace of being ridiculed. People don't want to be ridiculed. People don't want to be thought of as someone, you know, who's uneducated and stupid, and it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And certainly when you go back into the 50s, a lot of people were treated that way when they said that they saw something. So people basically clammed up. And we can go back to our friend Fife Symington, who later recanted, of course, but still, you know, dressed that guy up in an alien suit and everybody yucked it up, and so much for the Phoenix Lights. Mm-hmm. And it had the same results in Phoenix that, frankly, some of the even with Stephenville, this is almost 10 years later now, the people who saw it, some of the witnesses were very reticent about talking about it and coming out and saying something. And I asked her point blank. I said, you know, what do you think were the witnesses nervous, anxious, upset, or overwhelmed? And this is right from the book. She says, a few of the witnesses I spoke to were very shaken. One woman was almost in a state of shock. I would say most people were nervous about what they say, wondering if others saw the same thing. They were also afraid of being labeled or laughed at. A few were concerned about being targeted by investigators and media. So I mean, you can see that when a person, which amazes me really with Ricky Sorrell, because I know he's been on your show and lots of people have talked to this guy, History Channel, and he's just, you know, he just comes on and tells you what he saw, you know, and that's it. But it's interesting what Whitney tells us. One woman was almost in a state of shock. Most people were nervous. So, again, when people see these things, and even Ricky Sorrell used the same word, it was overwhelming. When you see a craft that's a mile and a half wide or larger, up close and personal like that, it's got to be, you know, so over the top, so totally over the top of anything we've ever looked at. And
I keep thinking of Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That look, exactly.
Same
exactly.
Thing. You know, it's interesting. Since I was on last, of course, the UK downloaded some of their so-called classified documents, and I thought this was real interesting. And it's so funny. The news cycle that we're in is like 12 hours, and it just fades off. News story, and that's it. And in a way, it was a major smoking gun, in my opinion. And you know, the UK released the UFO file. I guess it was from the 50s, and at the same time, they found the pilot who had made the report.
Yes.
And I'm sure you know the story, but what I found just incredible about it was here's the pilot coming on and telling us, the reason why I bring this up, the pilot tells us that this thing was larger than an aircraft carrier. I mean, that's big. Larger than an aircraft carrier, sitting there, and he's about to release all 24 of his weapons from his F-14. The thing takes off at 10,000 miles an hour. And yet, you know, I mean, people listen to that. The UK is releasing classified documents, and here's the pilot, you know, coming on the record, and yet it's almost like there's almost a stupor on the public at large, and not only here but worldwide. And it just amazes me. You would think that people would be clamoring what for more stories. What happened? Who is this guy? But, you know, it lasted 12 hours, and then it was off the media.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just no way we could have had anything like that during that time period.
Mm-hmm.
There's
mm-hmm.
no way.
Unbelievable.
I'm not even sure we could have it today, as a matter of fact. Mm. But you're right. And he was ordered. He was ordered to fire on this thing, and it just took off, and it was gone.
10,000 miles an hour. That's what he estimates it at. Ricky Sorrell saying that he was overwhelmed when he saw it. People that the reporter at the Stephenville Emporium, said the same thing, nervous. They were just in a state of shock. I mean, when you see something like this, it's unnerving. It's got to be unnerving.
An area that still puzzles me, Lynn, is the area of cattle mutilations, mm-hmm. which you rightfully looked into. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, it was really interesting. After I was on Coast to Coast about maybe a year and a half ago, and this always happens, people email me with stories and stuff, and one of these really piqued my interest, and it was by a father and son who had a ranch up in the eastern part of Oregon, where it's kind of dry and flat, I guess. I've never been up there, but that's what they tell me. And they had a cattle ranch up there, and it was pretty desolate. And, you know, he came on the record and, you know, in an email and said, you know, we saw some strange stuff, what I think was a cattle mutilation. And so I emailed him back, and we started up a correspondence, and I asked if he would go on the record, and he and his father agreed to. And, of course, all this is in a written format. Well, most of the interviews were done in a written format, which is great, so people can really think what they're saying and, you know, articulate it and get it down, get their thoughts together. And what was unnerving, you know, they the first time they were out there, and he tells from the first cow that they saw, they're out and they're working on the wells because they need to get the wells to feed the cattle. The ranch is just huge, and, you know, they would drive around in the trucks and stuff and start the pumps up and get the well. And while they're doing this, they look over and they see a dead cow. And there's nothing unusual about seeing a dead cow on a ranch.
It happens. That's right.
They go over to this thing, and, parts of it have been cored out. I think the rectum was cored out and the eye was cored out. And they're just looking at this thing going, like, what is this?
Yeah.
And they were totally mystified. What was interesting about the interview, again, it's not somebody, you know, you're not calling a reporter who talked to somebody who knew somebody. This is like these guys handled the stuff. They were there. They were the guys who called the police. And the local law enforcement people at first, you know, came out and looked at the thing, and after a while basically gave them the runaround. I mean, just would never investigate it, wouldn't do anything. And apparently some of the officers off the record, said to these two gentlemen who were the cattle ranchers, basically said that they were just told to stay away from it, to stay off of it. They had orders to just stay away from it, you know, don't give it any time. But this went on for years on this ranch, and they would come out and they would see the cows just mutilated in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes the flesh would be stripped down to the jawbone, the eye would be taken out, the udders would be cored out, the anus or the sexual organs would be cored out, and the coyotes wouldn't go near it. They talked about one time one of the horses would not go near the carcass. So there was like almost like a psychic residue, dare I use that term, but something is left over. The fact that coyotes won't go near it, and coyotes will eat anything. I mean, you know, I live in the Los Angeles Mountains, or the Santa Monica Mountains, rather, and, you know, the coyotes are up here, and I mean, they'll eat anything.
They come down to take little puppies that might be on the porch of somebody's house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't get near this thing. So, you know, and there was a special, I guess, on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, and these guys were staking out a cow, and they showed that some of this looks like the work of flies. And I would agree. You know, some of those incisions, flies can, and bacteria and stuff can eat and make it look that way. But that's not what these guys were talking about. Some of these carcasses were very fresh. They were drained of blood. The flies hadn't gotten there yet, and these things were cored out. No footprints around them. I mean, all the classic cattle mutilation stuff. And again, you know, when we start looking at what's all these different phenomena, first of all, I believe that they're all related. Now, you know, Chuck and Stan Moser, these are the cattle ranchers that were out there. They talked about feeling a presence when they'd be out on the range sometimes, especially when they would see a mutilated cow. They would feel as if they were being watched. I mean, you know, the guy told me it was just the creepiest feeling. Now, that could be imagined. I don't know. But on the other hand, were they picking up on something in the same way that the horse wouldn't get near the carcass? You know, the same mm-hmm. type of thing. Is there a residue? But I believe that all this phenomenon is connected, and I included it in the alien interviews because, once again, it's like a primer for the novice or a refresher course for people who have traveled in this stuff for years that, you know, the phenomenon is here, not going away. It's burgeoning, and we at least can agree that something is going on. We need to start dialoguing about this and talking about it.
Yeah, it truly is another bizarre facet of this puzzle. And, you know, it's almost as every category that is in the alien interviews, it's like a piece of a puzzle. And then as you keep putting them together, Lynn, you begin to see a bigger picture, don't you?
Well, I would hope so. And this is the deal. It's like, why are they taking cows? I mean, let's strip it down and walk through it. There are people that I've talked to, at any rate, you know, and I know that you know this, and your listeners, some of your listeners have heard this before, the idea of the vats and the underground bases and the hybrids being grown in these vats. I believe that. I've written about that. I've talked to people who have seen these things, allegedly. I wasn't there. I don't really want to be there to look at these things. But these people, you know, have sworn that's what they've seen. And this all goes into the breeding program, which is something that I really don't understand. Dr. Jacobs hasn't been there either. He hasn't seen it, but yet, you know, he knows about it, and I think that the cow's blood, which apparently, bovine blood apparently, in fact, in some, it's being used now in some hospitals, from what I understand, it's very close to human blood, apparently. So what are they doing with genetic material? Why are they taking it? But even more so than that, it's deliberate. It's a deliberate screw you. In other words, they're operating with complete impunity. They don't care about anything. You know, they, whoever is doing this, and of course I think it ties into the whole UFO thing, because people have seen and come on the record over the years. I know one person has come on the record seeing that they actually saw the cow, you know, rise up in a beam of light into the belly of the ship. So, and we've got reports on that. The bottom line is that they're doing it with impunity, and they dropped the carcass. I mean, surely if you were doing this thing and trying to be somewhat clandestine about it, wouldn't you, you know, cover the carcass or bury the thing
or just keep it, you know?
But they don't do that. They put it back on the ground as if to say, we can do whatever we want to do, and you guys can't do anything about it. And furthermore, when you really look at the carcasses and how they're desecrated, George. I mean, they are.
Yeah.
I mean, they're desecrated. It's like, it's so deliberate. It's, in my opinion, it's so deliberately evil, and that's why nothing will go around it. There's like, when I talked about that psychic residue, there's a residue of malevolence, a residue of evil around the carcass. You know, remember, the whole thing of blood and blood sacrifice, it's all linked together, in my opinion. Real creepy stuff.
I go around the country a lot, Lynn, in conferences here and there, and I always run into Dr. Roger Lear, who has become just one of my favorites. He's just an all-around good guy. But as you well know, when you interviewed him for the alien interviews, he wasn't always a believer that implants were coming from some other strange place, was he?
Well, he's so candid about that. And let me back up. Like 10 years ago, there was a little MUFON conference in Los Angeles, and I went down to it because Barry Chamish was speaking. I'm a Nephilim, and then I walk up to Barry and handed him my book, and he kind of looked shocked, and we talked, and you know, we've kind of had communications over the years. But Dr. Roger Lear was there, and he introduced himself, and we were talking about implants, and I think he had just done his first or his second or whatever, but it was in his nascent beginning of delving into this thing. And I said, well, what did it look like? And he kind of looks at me with this little impish grin and reaches into his coat pocket and pulls out a vial and goes, well, here it is. And he kind of shakes it in front of me, and my jaw drops to the ground. And I said, can I handle it? And he said, sure. And he pops the lid over and, you know, puts this thing in my hand. I'm just sitting there looking at it, just like, you know, dumbfounded, because I had never seen one. But to answer the question, when he was asked, Dr. Roger Lear was asked to take a look at this thing, and he was, I guess, the patient or the group of people were saying, we think it might be some sort of an implant by extraterrestrials. And when he heard that, he just got up and basically walked out of the room. I mean, he didn't want anything to do with this stuff. You know, you people are a bunch of kooks, you're crazies. And that's, isn't that sort of a typical reaction? I mean, I've had people.
Absolutely.
Look, I would go to the market, and I haven't seen somebody in a couple of years, and they go, what are you working on? And I go, I'm working on a book called The Alien Interviews. And they just, literally, the body language, they start moving away from me.
Backwards,
exactly. Okay, got a live one on aisle four. And it's like, what do you do with that? Anyway, Dr. Roger Lear was kind of cajoled, come on, you just take a look at this thing. And so I suppose reluctantly, he goes in and he performs the operation, and what he finds is quite startling to him. Let me see where.
And I witnessed, by the way, I went to an operation that he had done several years ago. Uh-huh. I may play it on tape again in another few weeks, but he and the surgeon could not extract this thing. Hmm. Every time they'd go to grab it, with tweezers, it moved. Mm-hmm. It moved. It's like it had little sensors on it. They finally got it. But, man, it was in the lady's face. And, I mean, they numbed her up. But I got to believe, had they not, she would have gone through excruciating pain, Len, as they tried to find this thing and pull it out.
He comes on the record, Dr. Roger Lear, and he says, all objects were covered with a very strange, tough, biological tissue that we could not cut through with a surgical blade. I mean, again, and let's here's another tentacle or another, you know, view of the same phenomena, because these people, you know, most of these abductees who have these implants are relieved, of course, when they're taken out, and that's one of the questions I ask them. But again, it ties back into the abduction phenomena. There's some sort of tracking device. That's what the Dr. Roger Lear believes, this thing. And again, it's like we at least can agree that the phenomena is happening. Something is going on, and we need to really, you know, open the floodgates and let the dialogue really start to begin. We need to get more scientists looking at this stuff instead of, you know, I mean, Dr. Roger Lear has got limited budgets. In fact, one of the things he talks about, you know, the skeptics are funded and the poor researcher's up there, you know, just on his own.
Yeah,
and he also makes comments that a lot of the scientific community, again, won't get near this because of the ridicule, because they're afraid of losing their post.
So true. So true. Good guy.
Yeah, he is.
And the field needs him. It really does. Another good guy, and we may not have time totally to talk about him. We'll have to do it next hour. But Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr., great, great human being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Went to Iraq at his age. Went to Iraq.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It really is. But why did you pick him?
Well, I picked him because it goes back into the 1947 Roswell crash. David Flynn has postulated that, and of course I'm getting ahead of myself here as usual, but David Flynn wrote a paper several years ago, which I actually included a link to it and talked about in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, the book that precedes the alien interviews. But Flynn talks about that according to the Book of Enoch, now we're back into ancient documents, thousands of years old, according to the ancient document of the Book of Enoch, the so-called fallen angels landed on Mount Hermon. And Flynn was able to postulate that if you were to take the opposite side of the pole from where Mount Hermon is, the direct opposite, 180 degrees away from where Mount Hermon is, same latitude, you wind up in Roswell, New Mexico, using the figures and the equations in a 360-day lunar year, or solar year, rather. Fascinating stuff. And, of course, when he wrote the paper, everybody just went, whoa, what's this? So, you know, was Roswell, New Mexico, a deliberate crash? And in my opinion, it was. It's sort of the beginning, as Stanton Friedman has said. I mean, this is sort of, everything is sort of built on the Roswell crash, in a way.
I mean, true.
Certainly things have moved up from that, and it's gotten way more complex than what we have in 47. But, you know, Dr. Stanton Friedman was the guy that blew that open, and Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. talks about that. What I found fascinating, and he doesn't know this, he was actually the model for the one of the characters in the Nephilim trilogy, the whole story of handling the debris wreckage. And what I had done in the novel in the Nephilim trilogy was to actually, his father had spirited away a piece of the wreckage. He didn't give it all back, and so he still had it. It was under the floorboards in the
with
house.
With bizarre symbols on it, right?
But, you know, Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. comes on the record, and it's just, there's the bumper music.
That's okay. You're good. You've been on this show way too much. If you know what that means, we'll be back in a moment.